Okay. All right, here's a question. Okay, what do I suggest for old Bibles that are falling apart? What did they do in the first century to worn out scrolls? Well, second answer first. So what did they do in the first century? They copied them. So if you'd like to make a hand copy, you know, buy a couple of spiral notebooks, a couple of dozen spiral notebooks, and start copying, you can do that. That's what they did, and they did that until the invention of the printing press. So the amazing thing is that for 1,400 years, whenever a scroll got worn out or was starting to get worn out, they would make a copy of it. So we owe some people a debt of gratitude for their sore arms as they did that. And, you know, the other thing is, you know, the expense that, I don't know what papyrus cost. I haven't seen the price, but I read that, in the medieval period when they were still making copies by hand, that the price of a piece of parchment or vellum, that the best comparison for what that costs today is an equivalent size piece of, 3/4 inch plywood. So, you know, if you're thinking about the size of, and they use like, you know, the pew Bibles, the great big ones. So, the pulpit Bibles. So they had these big pages, and the amazing thing is they left so much space on them, because one of the reasons is they make little comments. You messed up, you know, I've got a better copy, and your copy didn't have the right word here, so I'm fixing it. But they left those margins because they didn't want to change the actual text. So that's what they did in the first century, really all the way through the 15th century. So what do I suggest for old Bibles that are falling apart? I would say retire it with dignity. they're a book, right? You know, I know we invest them with a lot of, there's a lot of symbolism. There's a lot of, superstition that can be associated with Bibles. When I was a kid, I could not abide if I put a Bible back on the shelf upside down. It was like, uh-oh, now I'm in trouble. You know, demons are going to possess me or something. So I was really superstitious. I would say throw it away, right? Just dispose of it the way you would any other block of paper. So I would say that. On the other hand, I had a pastor when we lived in Colorado, and his was held together by duct tape, and he was like, that was my Bible, and he wrote in it all the time. And so that, you know, I would have retired it. I've got like 14 or 15 over there because I compare translations and so forth. So I don't have notes in any one particular Bible the way he did. So retire it and get a new one would be my advice. And particularly, how old is it? If it's more than 50 or 60 years old, I would say there's probably a better translation, because they were just starting to bring the scholarship from the Dead Sea Scrolls into the translations about 60 years ago. So if you can find something newer, it'll include more scholarship. So, all right. Next. All right. Here's a question. Why does the Reformed Church not believe, in quotes, believe, or follow the Catholic belief of transubstantiation for the Lord's Supper? Why do we do that? So this is half of this church is a Reformed Church. That's the Presbyterian half. The Methodist half is influenced by the Reformed tradition, but it's not actually Reformed. So why do we not have transubstantiation? So you can see part of the answer is right here. When Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, he said, do this in remembrance of me. But he also said, this is my body. And that's really where the argument lies, is that some people said, well, this is a thing we do in remembrance. Other people said, no, it's the same thing. It's exactly the same. It is literally an offering of the body of Christ to God. So that is the argument. So what is transubstantiation? Transubstantiation is the doctrine, for example, the Catholic Church down the road here, they adhere to a doctrine called transubstantiation. Across the street from them at Gloria Dei Lutheran, they adhere to a doctrine called consubstantiation. And it all has to do with the idea of a substance. So what is a substance? Well, picture in your mind a tree. Okay? So you got a picture of a tree, right? Now, chances are that tree doesn't really exist anywhere, right? It is in your mind, right? And so in the philosophy of the first century, there was this idea that there is the real thing, the tree, you know, as God designed trees to be. And then here in this world, there are imperfect copies of trees. And so the idea is that there is an essence of Christ. There is a substance. The substance of Christ is the real Christ. And then there is the accident of Christ, which is the body he was in. So this difference between substance and accidents. So the trees outside, you know, there was that lightning bolt that broke off a branch, you know, they aren't perfect. They aren't the ideal tree the way God designed trees to be. So that was basically the debate. And they said that the substance of Christ either really does, the elements of communion really do become the substance of Christ. The accidents stay the same. It's still bread, still wine. But the substance is now transformed. So that's the doctrine of transubstantiation. Lutherans have consubstantiation, which says it's somewhere right nearby, or it's with. The substance of God, of Christ is with the elements of communion. And then there are the people who say this that it is a sign and a seal. Somebody mentioned the sign and seal. So what is a sign, right? There's a exit sign right there. Now, if the building catches fire, you don't run to the sign, right? But the sign points to you where the exit is, right? There's a sign back there. You don't run to the exit sign, but the sign is important in understanding where the thing is that it's pointing to. So that's the other understanding, is that the elements of communion are a sign that the body of Christ is invisibly nearby. But we can't make God connect them somehow so that we could carry it outside or whatever. You know, so God is telling us that Christ is truly nearby. The substance of Christ is nearby, but this is only a sign, and so the sign simply points to it without actually becoming it. So that's the three different understandings of the sacraments. There's a fourth understanding, but it's not for sacraments. It is the idea that this is just an act of obedience to what Christ called us to do this in remembrance of him. And so they would call that, in churches that do that, instead of calling it a sacrament, they would call it an ordinance. So it's something God told them to do, so they're doing it. And it is specifically an act in memorial of what it was that Christ did. So three versions of sacraments and one version of ordinances. So, all right. Next, what kind of drug or alcohol problems did they have in Jesus' time? All right. Well, I assume all the kinds. I mean, I know some drugs are native to the New World, so they didn't have those. But, you know, if you think of particular mushrooms or something like that. But they had alcohol for sure. We don't see much about it. There are some references to alcohol in the Bible, people talking about drunkenness. But about half the time, those are metaphors. It says, you know, they have drunk deeply of God's wrath or something like that. So this idea is, even when they're talking about drunkenness, it may not be an alcoholic stupor they're talking about, but a metaphor for something else. Now, if you're going to use a metaphor for something like I did with trees, presumably it's something people are familiar with, right? You all have seen a tree, so I could use that as a metaphor. So if in the Bible they're talking about drunkenness as a metaphor, that tells you that people are probably using it, at least from time to time. They had those problems. It's hard to tell exactly how common they were. And one of the reasons is because, you know, we don't appreciate just how poor people were in the first century. And so, Most people, you know, unless you were really rich, you were poor. There wasn't a middle class. There's nothing remotely like a middle class. And by poor, I mean maybe we'll have dinner tonight. That's how poor we're talking about. So they didn't, you know, it was a rare person who could afford enough alcohol to get drunk. And so we read about, you know, when Jesus changes water into wine, that's at a festival, right? There's a special occasion. This is an occasion for everybody in the village. Whoever got invited to the wedding, they're all going to actually get a little bit loose because they can afford that much alcohol, or, you know, because it is such a special occasion. So there were those opportunities, that there'd be something that somebody would be providing it and they would have saved up for it. The other thing is they didn't have water purification. So in a sense, everybody was always drinking alcohol. What they would do is they'd put enough alcohol in their water to kill whatever might give them stomach problems. So people would regularly drink something. They'd take a cup of wine or they'd take a cup of water and they'd put about a quarter of it would be wine. So it'd be enough to make sure that the bugs died or whatever, but that's about it. So that's what I know. All right. What does Jesus say about homelessness? Okay. All right. What does Jesus say about homelessness? The Bible. All right. So somebody asked, what does Jesus say? Let's see what Jesus had to say. The one that comes to my mind, actually, so sorry, I'll answer this in two ways. So in Matthew 25, that's on page 28 in the back of the numbering starts over. So the part closest to the end, page 28, is Matthew 25, and Jesus has this parable, the parable of the sheep and the goats. So he says, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He'll put the sheep at his right hand and the goats at his left. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, come you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. Now you can read that as a exhaustive list, that if somebody has a need that's not in that list, then Jesus doesn't care if you take care of it. I don't think that's a reasonable way of reading the scriptures. So when it comes to a question like homelessness, so I just saw an article, what is it? The median price of a home in Anchorage is $513,000. And the median price of a condo is like $280,000. So you've got to have some real income before you can buy a home. So there is an economic problem with homelessness, that the supply does not match the demand. So there is that, or I mean, at that price it does. But for people who have less income, you know, you're looking at anything from having a roommate, you know, if you're renting, to, you know, couch surfing, to living in your car. So there is actual economic need. Now, in our country, you know, I saw there was a map. So it was a map of homelessness in the nation. And what was interesting is that it really varies by state. And so that tells you that the policies that are put into effect to address homelessness have something to do with the amount of homelessness. And so, for example, New York State has the highest rate of homelessness in the country. California has a high rate. Oddly enough, Alaska has a very high rate. But if you go to Omaha, there's a very low rate of homelessness in Nebraska. And so that tells you it's probably not only economic problems, although it certainly is probably cheaper to live in Omaha than in Anchorage. But it's not just that. There's something to do with the policies that the place has put in practice. house prices are high in Florida and Texas, but the rate of homelessness is low there. So what is that? You know, people can argue about the best policies. So there is an issue of what are the policies that are being put into effect. And lastly, there is the previous question about drunkenness. There's a reality that a lot of the people who are suffering homelessness, we might say, are outdoors because they have untreated problems. They may have drug abuse problems, drug or alcohol abuse problems. They may have mental illness problems. They may have mental illness problems that they're self-medicating with alcohol or drugs. And so I've seen estimates up to 80 to 90% of the people who are homeless are in that category. And so if you see somebody outdoors, they're more likely to be in that situation. Somebody who's poor is more likely to have insecure housing. So they're living in their car now, and then they're living in a friend's living room for a week or whatever. So they're bouncing around, they're moving around. If they have kids, the kids have a very uncertain school situation. You know, where can they go to school? So there's a lot of problems like that. But it's more complicated than just the money problem. So what I would say is that Jesus has the same answer for everybody, that if you help those who need help, then he sees that as if you were doing it for him. And if you don't help people who need help, he sees that as refusing to help him. So I'm gonna add another reading just because it gives a different flavor. So in chapter 17 of Luke, which is on page 90, is it 17? Sorry, 16. So page 79 of the New Testament, Jesus tells the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. So he says, there's a rich man who is dressed in purple and fine linen and was feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who longed to satisfy his hunger with what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs would come and lick his sores. The poor man died and was carried away by the angels to be with Abraham. The rich man died and was buried. Notice the contrast, right? Dumped, right? In Hades, where he was being tormented, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus at his side. And he said, send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue. And Abraham said, no, during your lifetime you received good things, and Lazarus in manner evil things. But now he's comforted and you're in agony. So Luke tells us this other parable of Jesus where it's very strong language about people, where there's the ability to help and the need. In Matthew's gospel, there's this idea, well, you can do something, right? You can visit somebody who's in prison or whatever. But in Luke, he's specifically focusing on people who have the ability to make a difference, people who are wealthy. And so I would just say we're all wealthy. Everybody in this room is in the top 10% of global wealth. So I know it doesn't feel that way, but you are, and so am I. So something to think about is what to do with the wealth you've got. Lastly, I would say this. I don't think Jesus, if you make an attempt and are not successful, I think Jesus will count that, you know, he grades on a curve, right? So if you're saying I'm not successful at, you know, eliminating homelessness, yes. But on the other hand, if you simply say, well, it's not my problem because I get taxed every year and my taxes go to help the homeless, and you say, I'm doing something for the homeless, I don't think Jesus is going to grade that the same way he will an honest effort to help somebody who's real. So I don't think he's as interested in a program as or for that matter a solution as he is in the human individual. One of the things we try to do here is we try to have hands-on ministry opportunities so that people can actually go see real homeless people or real women who have left their home because of domestic violence or things like that, where we actually have the opportunity to see real people instead of hypothetical people. Because I think hypothetical people, I can hypothetically help them with my taxes. But real people, I actually want to say, well, gosh, you know, is there something I can do here? So I would encourage you to do something. What does it Jesus say about homelessness? My personal advice is try to do something with real people instead of hypothetical people. All right. One more question. Oh, my goodness. All right. So 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 2. So where is 2 Corinthians? So these are in the Pew Bible. I can't put the slides up because it's real time, and so I don't know what they are. So, Tom could be typing very quickly, but 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Where are we? 2 Corinthians 12. So that's page 186. Oh, sorry. Page 185 in the Pew Bible. All right, so Paul is writing to the Corinthians, and the specific question is, what is the third heaven? So what is the third heaven? So chapter 12, verse 1, he says, I will go on to visions and revelations in the Lord. I know a person in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. All right, so a whole bunch in there. So Paul is talking about the whole context is Paul's talking about how if God has authorized him to be an apostle to the church in Corinth, then how come he's not a good preacher? How come he doesn't look very impressive? How come he keeps getting beat up? And so forth. And so Paul has been arguing about those different things. Then he says, okay, people say, you know, but you don't have visions the way other people do. You know, that, you know, this charismatic preacher over here, he came through our town and man, he was tripping. So why aren't you like that? And so Paul says, yes, okay, well, if I'm going to boast about it, he says, I also have visions and revelations in the Lord. And then specifically he says, I know a person in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Now, what people believe Paul is saying here is this is just some kind of odd for us way to say he, right? I know a person who blah, blah, blah. I know a person who runs marathons, right? If I say that, you know it's not me. But if I say I know a person who surfs the web, you know, I could be talking about me. So Paul is probably talking about himself, and he says he was caught up to the third heaven. So what is the third heaven? So the third heaven, the word heaven is the word for air, and it's also the word for atmosphere. So the first heaven is right here, right? It's what we're breathing. Okay. The second heaven is what I see when I look up, right? It's gray or blue or whatever color it is today, right? So it's the dome over my head. So it is the second heaven. And then above that, beyond the dome of the sky is the realm of God. So that would have been the conventional picture people would have had in the first century. So he's saying, I was in the realm of God. He wasn't saying I was on the moon or in the stars. He was saying I was beyond our regular earth. So I was caught up into the third heaven. So I was caught up into what we would say is to heaven. So I wasn't floating there in midair, and I wasn't just right here. I got the full treatment. So he says, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. He says, you know, how do you know that thing, right? You're having some mystical experience, You're in an unfamiliar place. Everything is strange. How can you tell if you're really there or if you're, you know, in your body or if that's part of the mystical experience? And he says he was caught up into paradise and heard things that are not to be told, that no mortal is permitted to repeat. So on behalf of such a one, in other words, so this person who he's distancing himself because that person boasts, the one he's talking about, but he doesn't want to be that person. He's saying, I know that person, but I don't want to be that person, so I'm not going to, on my own behalf, I will not boast except of my weaknesses. So technically that is the third heaven. It's just a fancy way of saying heaven, and it has to do with the way that they saw the world in those days. But practically what it means is the fullness of an experience of God. So, when Isaiah has a vision, he sees the Lord in the temple. And then he goes on to describe, the only thing he describes is the hem of God's robe. And so, you know, he's not looking up or something, you know, he's keeping his eyes down. I don't know what he's doing, but when he has this vision, it's too much to describe. So where was he? Was he really in the temple, or was he caught up into the third heaven, and he could only describe the parts that looked like the temple to him, or the parts that he could interpret as being the temple? So, all right. So those are the questions you have asked, and I don't think. Yeah, okay, I got them all. So, thank you again. I really appreciate the opportunity to do this. It really does help me become a better preacher, and I hope it also answers the questions that you have. So.